guessing that the launch of a Falcon, for instance, has a temperature sensor in it, among other things. So in other words, all kinds of health can be launched after, health can be monitored after launch. The early predictions by Elon Musk was making predictions not very many years ago that he would have people going to the vicinity of Mars by the year 2018 or 2020. He had some very optimistic reports about the hardware he's going to build that would be human space possible. Still, he is the leader of all the commercial NASA replacements. Isn't that true? At least stateside. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, optimistic, but a lot of things he says do come true, of course. Sometimes down the road a piece. So, for instance, the heavy Falcon Heavy that he launched, that was in the news a few months ago, back in February. That was, now that was supposed to be 2013, so he's 5 years behind on that. So he makes the predictions of launching these things. And originally it was going to land, launch out of Vandenberg Air Force Base. That changed it. That launched out of Cape Canaveral. He took all the launch complex 39A to launch that. And he launches, he's got two complexes in Florida. He's got launch complex 39A. That's the one that NASA used for the moon, Saturn missions and shuttle missions. And then he's got launch complex 40 there that he launches spacecraft out of. And now he's got one in California, Vandenberg Air Force Base. And he's eventually going to have one in Texas. There's a place that, called, it's right near Brownsville, Texas. That's a way to put it. Very close to the Mexican-Texan border. He's building, or has been doing it for probably the last 5 years. Let me drop it. So Elon Musk with SpaceX, yes, he makes these predictions. He should have been launching out of Texas by now. That's what I was getting at. But will he be doing it? Yes, he will. I'm sure he will. There's two people that, you said Mars, he had plans on sending somebody around the moon in 2018. He made that prediction. Two billionaires, we don't know who they are, apparently, made a commitment to Elon Musk that they wanted to take a flight around the moon. And he came out with that a couple of years ago. And that's not going to happen, of course, anytime soon. But will it happen? It could. That's the goal. He would like to do that. Even though he's all about Mars, his goal is really to develop the big, big Falcon rocket now, the VFR, and send that all the way to Mars. He's making plans and building things for it now. Let me drop it. You know, originally that was supposed to have a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine. Now he has switched to liquid methane. The engine itself was supposed to be a lot larger. He's cut the size of the thrust down on the they call the Raptor engine by a little bit. So his predictions are you know, never right on the money, but sometimes they're close. He was going to have a lot more engines on the first stage. I think he was going to have 42. I think it's 30 something now, 31 engines. So whether or not they come true or not, you know, he's pretty good. He's got a lot of these billionaires doing what he's doing, but none of them are succeeding like this guy. Last year, I think he had 18 launches from SpaceX. This year, they said he's on track to launch about 30 missions. So each year, it's almost like the Moore effect. You know, he's trying to double it every 18 months. Moore's law. But what else has he got going? He's got so much. He's got the crew vehicles, the unmanned crew vehicles, will be launched, my guess, by the end of this year. And double dock to the International Space Station. The actual crew vehicle, it's going to go up there without any people. But, it's going to be all autonomous. If there was somebody in it, they would make it all the way to the space station and back. So, first crewed mission, they kind of got planned for probably the spring of next year. And they were in competition with Boeing. Boeing has got their vehicle that they plan on launching around the same time as Elon Musk. The Boeing vehicle is called Starliner spacecraft. And that's under development. Actually, they got three of them under development right now in Florida. Back to you, Dick. WSY.
I have the impression that Elon Musk, by way of all of the cargo deliveries he does to the International Space Station and all the launches he's doing for multiple organizations, that he's got a significant cash flow from his successful launches. As such, he has the cash continuously flowing by which he can be doing continuous development of other launch vehicles and spacecraft. Of all of the non-NASA American sites that can, organizations that can do launches, it appears to me that he's out in front and he's going to stay there. That doesn't look like any of the other organizations are likely to catch up with him. That's a guess on my part, and give me your impression on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, I agree. The other guy's got money behind him, too. That would be like for instance, Jeff Bezos. Like the richest guy in the world now, they say. And he's behind Blue Origin. So, he's going along step by step. And is he catching up? I don't know. I don't think he's really... I think they're going in slightly different paths. But, the first launch of people into space, even though it might be a suborbital flight, might be by Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin, with the new Shepard rocket that he's been developing. He's up to the third iteration of it. And the one he's got now, he's running some more tests on it. He just made a successful flight a couple months ago. And if it works out, by the end of this year, he might be able to put a test flight together and have somebody go above the Kármán line, that 100-kilometer line, and it's probably 62 miles into space. So he might do it first. But as far as orbiting, I would say as long as everything holds together with SpaceX, next year you're going to see people launching from Launch Complex 39A. And he's got everything set up. He's got the tower built. He's got the white room built. And dropped. He's got the recovery ships ready to go. There's an emergency off the Atlantic. He pays for all of this stuff. He's a billionaire. He started off with PayPal. He's one of the guys that started PayPal. He sold that out to, I believe it was eBay. And now he's parlayed that money to the space program. Started off with Falcon 1. He's working his way up to Falcon 9. Soon to be the big Falcon rocket, the VFR. I like the older name anyway. The older name was the Mars Colonial Transport. I like that one better. But don't forget, he's taking this money and not only put it into the space program. He's put it into the Tesla motor. Going to try to eventually make big bucks with Tesla. And both have gigantic manufacturing plants going in California. And he's also the owner of Solar City, all these people putting solar panels on their roof, buildings all throughout the country. He's involved with that too, so I guess he's got an income from that. He's definitely got an income from the watches. He's watching for NASA, he's watching for all these different countries that, you know, he just launched one from Bangladesh. They're all paying him to do this, and each one is at least $50 million. I think he said $62 million per launch. Back to you, Dick.
It seems like a year or two or three ago, Elon Musk was doing a lot of things like the Mars Colonial Transport, which is now the BFR. Big Falcon rockets. Other people give it other names for BFR, but Mars Colonial Transport, and he was doing a lot of talk about heavy lift capability, putting people on Mars, colonizing Mars. I'd like to believe he's going to slowly back off on that, because people to go to Mars thinking they're going to be the early colony, that is very impractical. From my point of view, I think in a very short period of time, a person living on Mars would become extremely unhappy. Living in a spacesuit is not comfortable. Living in a habitat is not comfortable. The habitat will never be a big, luxurious house on Mars. Growing your own food there has some huge problems with it. So I'd like to believe he's backed off on colonizing Mars. I mean, to make it, let me drop. There are various websites that will say that we should have Mars as a backup Earth in case Earth gets hit with a very large asteroid or meteorite or whatever, that Mars is going to be a backup Earth. Mars is so lacking in any of the raw materials and capability to sustain life. I'd like to believe he is backing off on colonization of Mars. What's your opinion on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
I haven't heard that he's backing off on it. You know, I guess you could say that he'd like to do that. And until it happens, or doesn't happen, you know. Even if 20 years go by, you know, you can still be saying, I'd like to do it, I'm just late. It's like Falcon Heavy, you know, 5 years late, but, you know, eventually we'll do it. So I don't know. Now, you know, everybody goes after his statements, you know, and what he would like to do with Mars and create a town up there. What about Jeff Bezos? Jeff Bezos was Blue Origin. And, you know, he wants to put 1 million people. He'd like to live to see the day to have 1 million people in space, on the moon or in space stations, manufacturing things. He wants to set up manufacturing plants. You know, this is one of his goals, you know, his long-term goal. And that's why he's building the they call it the New Glenn. You know, I talked about the New Shepard before, that's the suborbital one. He named it that because Alan Shepard was, you know, suborbital flight, first flight, little, you know. A lot of people forget he was also one of the people that went to the moon. But, you know, that's the Shepard. Now he's got the New Glenn. And that's being built right now in Florida, not too far from the launch complex. He's taken over Launch Complex 36. It's Jeff Bezos now. He's going to launch eventually the New Glenn from there. This thing is big, you know, I think it's just a little shorter than the Saturn V. So he's planning on building the New Glenn.
Repeater, time out.
Okay, I timed it out, but he's planning on building the New Glenn and eventually sending people up from Launch Complex 36 down to Florida. I mean, initially, the flights will be unmanned, but eventually his goal is to have manned flights go up. So he also has under development something called Blue Moon. The Blue Moon is a lander. Right now it's going to be unmanned, but a good-sized lander. Where you can bring thousands and thousands of pounds of cargo to the moon. These are some of the billionaires that are out there. There's quite a few more too, but Peter Beck and Richard Branson, everybody's got their own rockets and versions of it. And I'm wondering if there's going to be a demand for all these rockets that we have being constructed. China right now has launched their first commercial rocket, a commercial company in China. I'm wondering if there's going to be a real demand for all these satellites and rockets, things that are going to be put up in space. I hope there is. Back to you, sir.
Yeah, stand by, Lotus, Paul. I want to let the machine completely drop and reset everything because 375 went out and now it's back on a internet link with delay. Let's let this machine drop and see if everything will reset. K2RIW standing by.
K2RIW, K2JS.
Yeah, has the RF link to 375 failed, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's up to ISO, what's happening. The amplifier seems to, when it gets warm or when it doesn't like it, it doesn't want to put any output out, so I just switch it back over to the internet.
Okay, maybe I should stop worrying. So we have full linking to and from 375, just there is the internet latency. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, that's correct. Well, while you guys were talking, it would play, and then when he would drop, it wouldn't come back. So I saw that happening once while I was up there. So we'll go this way for a while until I bring another amplifier up.
So that amplifier has a hot transistor that's not being properly heat sunk, and it overheats and stops putting out RF power. Is that a rough guess as to what might be going on?
Well, it could be one of three things. Those power transistors are screwed into the heat sink really tight. It's not a question of it getting too hot. There is a couple of monitoring circuits in the amplifier. It could be there. The repeater itself gives it instructions to how much power to put out and whether or not it's in transmit mode or not. So the failure could be either the processor board and the repeater itself. There's something called a TR shelf, which has the D-to-A converter for how much power it puts out. Or it could be the input transistor, actually, it's encrypted in with plus 10 dBm. It drops it down to 0 dBm. Then it goes into another transistor that brings it up to, I think, 13 dBm, and that in turn drives the driver transistor. So, take your pick.
How many people out there, Eric, have all of your smarts and all of these systems that are able to maintain all of this? If you became ill next week, who would be able to maintain all of this equipment that you're maintaining? I wonder if you should consider training an apprentice that can either take over some of this or at least be able to maintain it if you're not able to. As it is right now, we got to make double darn sure you stay very, very healthy. You better be eating lots of vitamins and minerals. K2EJ, K2IW.
I've been asking for somebody to train, but there's a double whammy here. They have to know computers as much as they have to know electronics. I mean, as far as the radio stuff is concerned, there's a number of people out there that do this for a living. Mr. WAK used to do it. Andy can do it if he ever gets around to it. And a few other people can deal with the radio portion of it. Then we got some other guys who can deal with the The software portion of it, some of which I wrote, some of which Bernie wrote, but there's nothing magic in it if you're a computer guy. Okay, there is smarts out there, but it's distributed in multiple heads. And to get those multiple heads together and get them with authorization to be able to go there, that strikes me as there's a number of gating items there, Eric. Go ahead. No, let's put it this way. If I had someone I trained and was good at both departments, I'd have no problem having them get up there. It's just a matter of convincing someone that they know what they're doing. Okay, maybe I'm worrying unnecessarily. Paul, getting back to my original questions now. If Bezos, I think it is dreaming about putting up large number of people into space, a sort of a space colony, floating, weightless space colony, maybe on a great big rotating wheel, so it's got some artificial gravity, and he wants to put, I think you said, 1,000 people in space. Whoa. To put anything more than a couple of people in space represents a serious problem. I mean, look at the number of cargo trips it takes to the International Space Station to maintain those 3, 4, 5, 6 astronauts. We all forget about the fact that to maintain a human being takes a lot of raw materials. Let me drop it. A single human being in 1 year breathes a certain amount of air, drinks a certain amount of water, eats a certain amount of food. That air, food, and water has the volume of your house and the mass of your house. That's how much supplies you have to have per human being, per year, to sustain him. And the laws of physics maintain that that amount of mass of liquid, solid, and gas going into the human being, you have the exact same amount of liquid, solid, and gas coming back out of the human being as waste products that has to be handled. So a house full of raw materials goes into the human being, and a house full of raw materials comes back out of the human being per one human being per year. I mean, there's a hell of a lot of things that Mother Nature and Earth supplies to us and we don't even think about. You put a man into space, and you've got to supply all of that. I can't believe he really thinks he's going to put a large number of people in space, and they really want to go there and stay there for a long period of time. Maybe I'm being overly pessimistic. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Well, possibly, but, you know, it's nice to say that you're going to put 1,000,000 people up. I'd be happy to see him get off the launch pad. You know, I've seen his suborbital flights. You know, every one of them, he's done that 8 times so far. Launched the New Shepard into space and comes back and lands vertically. Does that very well. He's got something called a BE-3 engine, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. He gets a new Glenn off the launch pad by 2020, 2021 even. I'll be happy to see that. Like I said, large, maybe almost as big as the Saturn V. He's got 2 versions of it. He's going to have a 2-stage rocket and a 3-stage rocket. The 3-stage rocket is almost as big as the Saturn V. And all going to be run on methane, liquid methane. And I think one of the reasons he's choosing that, they both are SpaceX as well. It's actually less expensive. Methane is easier to get than liquid hydrogen, and easier to supply. The goal is to make space flight cheaper. SpaceX is on, on the right track. I mean, they've launched at least a dozen of these first stage rockets a couple of times. They've all been launched. If it goes up once, they'll launch it again, and then that's it. It's canceled. So you get 2 launches per booster up until now. out. Just a couple.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
I'm not on HF, that's for sure. You know, a couple of weeks ago, he launched his final version of the Falcon 9, called Block 5. Now, this one went up successfully. Came back and landed on an autonomous drone out, you know, 400 miles out to sea in the Atlantic Ocean. Brought that back, and that will, this version, Block 5, will be able to be launched 10 times without any maintenance whatsoever. After 10 times, then it will be refurbished and launched another 10 times. He thinks he could get up to 100 launches per rocket booster. So that's going to drive the cost down. All you have to do is supply the fuel like a jet, you know, and then launch it and bring it back.
Yeah, let me ask you a question about economics. Let me drop for a second. Since the United States canceled the space shuttle quite a few years ago, the only way we can get an astronaut up to the International Space Station is by the Russian rocket, Soyuz. I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to make a guess that we pay $20 million per launch of a human being or something like that. When SpaceX or its equivalent starts doing it, my guess is the price is going to be a lot cheaper to get a man to the International Space Station. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW?
Yeah, I know it's going to be cheaper, but I haven't read the cost yet. And over time, it will probably drop. In the beginning, it will be higher, no doubt, and then eventually come down. They'll be launching four people at a time instead of three at a time with the Soyuz rocket, so that will be cost-effective there. They'll be able to have a permanent crew of seven on board the International Space Station instead of six. That's the Dragon proposal. They will be doing that. And the cost per astronaut that the Soviets are doing, roughly around $70 million, 70, per flight. It used to be a lot less. I remember it used to be, you know, $30 million and $40 million, and it just kept going up to $70 million. We drop it.
You said seven?
Charles Bolden, the last administrator, he says he does not want to fill out one more check to the Roscosmos, to the Russian version of NASA, for any more flights if he has to. And he was really hoping that SpaceX would be online soon, or the Starliner. Like I mentioned before, Starliner being built by Boeing to put into space, also to the International Space Station. Again, four people per flight, so it's going to drop the cost significantly. But landing these things on the ocean, on these drone ships, is very important. And Elon Musk, he's not the only one with that idea. When Jeff Bezos with the New Glenn rocket starts launching, he's going to have his own ship out there catching these things as they come down. So he's going to be doing the same thing. So they both have the same kind of idea. I think there was a problem with patents or something in the beginning. You know, somebody stealing somebody's idea, but that's all been worked out back in the day.
So if I heard you correctly, the Russians were charging per human being that they brought up with Soyuz. Numbers like 20, 30, 40, and it's now up to $70 million per human being. And I guess because we have no choice, we have we have to pay the price, no matter what it is. Wow. Your best guess, how soon will Dragon or SpaceX or Elon Musk be able to launch human beings? I think you're saying he possibly will be ready to launch human beings to the International Space Station in not much longer than a year. So does that mean we're going to have to pay the $70 million one or two more times, even though the administrator doesn't want to write another check? Over you, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, they're going to give the Russians a couple more flights anyway. In fact, they just announced two more astronauts that will be going up toward the end of 2019 on the Soyuz rocket. So there'll be a couple of flights that's going to be at some point there's going to be, you know, you'll see a Russian flight with an American going, and you'll see a Dragon going up. There'll be some kind of a time you'll see, probably I'm going to guess about a year of that kind of thing happening. But your first human flight by SpaceX, if you look at the manifest, I mean, they're pushing it. They say there's going to be an uncrewed vehicle very soon. Let me drop it. Within a couple of months, I think August to August, and then a crewed vehicle by the end of the year. You know how this goes. It will probably be pushed back, you know, I'm going to guess the beginning of 2019, for the actual first crew, and they'll send two people up. It's supposed to be one NASA astronaut and one private commercial astronaut from SpaceX. When Boeing does it on the Starliner, it's going to be the same thing. One astronaut from NASA and one from Boeing. And NASA has sent four astronauts, two to Boeing and two to SpaceX about three years ago or so. Toni Williams is one of them. She's one of the more famous astronauts. And they've been working with this company, giving their input from NASA. You know, the controls aren't right, the screen isn't right, the seat isn't right, access, you know, and safety. They've been, you know, giving their two cents for the last, I guess, about 3 years now on the development of both Dragon crew and Starliner.
Once we have all this other American launching facilities for putting astronauts onto the International Space Station, and we're going to be keeping seven astronauts on board the International Space Station, is there enough work 7 days a week to keep seven astronauts busy? And now you need a lot more cargo ships bringing up raw materials to maintain seven people. Right now, we don't average more than, what, four, five, or six during the average year on the International Space Station. Clear me up on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
That's about 10 cargo flights per year. You have three, roughly three, sometimes maybe four, usually three Soyuz, not Soyuz, Progress missions, Progress from Russia, and then you usually run three or four Dragon cargo missions up to the space station. You're running usually around two, sometimes three, usually about two Cygnus ones, the one that just launched last week by Orbital ATK out of Virginia. And then you have Japan launches the HTV out of Japan. And they usually do that once a year. So it's roughly about 10 missions. We used to have the European Space Agency launch they had the ATV, I used to call it the Automatic Transfer Vehicle, from French Guiana, and that was large. I mean, they were bringing up, you know, 12, 13, 14,000 pounds each flight. That was a large vehicle. Let me drop it. And they did that roughly once a year for about 5 or 6 years. And that ATV was so successful, they've taken that whole system, and that's going to be part of the service module of the new Orion system when that's finally built, that NASA's building that NASA has got the European Space Agency as a partner. You know, NASA's building the Orion spacecraft that will eventually go to Mars, and you need a service module, and they're taking the blueprint from the ATV that used to go off to the International Space Station as a propulsion module for Orion being built by European Space Agency. So, roughly about 10 flights. I got off track. Back to you, Dick.
Let me ask you, is anyone out there want to ask any questions on the space report to Paul right now? Please give me your call letters. K2LAW listening.
Dick, I have a question, but it's not on the space report. M2EL.
Yeah, we got K2LEG ahead of you. Rich. Okay, I got you on my list. Anyone with any further questions for Paul on the space report, please give me your call letters right now.
KD2PPF, just a quick question about the ISS.
It sounded like Kilo Delta 2 Papa Papa Sierra. Start off with your name, sir, and go right ahead with your question. And it doesn't have to be quick. Take your time.
Hey, it's Papa Foxtrot. I was just wondering, I remember when, a long time ago, Skylab fell from the sky. I'm just wondering if the ISS has any propulsion systems to actually keep it in orbit, or if it's in an orbit that it doesn't need that.
Yeah, Papa Papa Foxtrot, when I pass it over to you, make sure you wait for the beeps. Over to you, Paul, on that one.
Okay, I missed his name. ISS has a module at the back, that's the module, and that's actually the living quarters of the Russians. When the Russians go up there, that's where they hang out, that's where they sleep. Actually, that's where two of them sleep. In the back, they have this propulsion module. It's part of that. And runs on hydrazine fuel, and that has to be refueled on a regular basis. So sometimes you'll send the Progress supply flight from Russia. It'll dock in that apt port, and they'll open a door and they'll bring in all the supplies, the food, and whatever they're going to bring in to for the Russians. But then there's automatic piping that's connected to the ISS. And the fuel flows into the ISS, and that refuels that part of it. This way, if the Progress ship is not there anymore, and they need to move this station, they could put those thrusters on. Let me drop it. But most of the times, what they do is they'll take the Progress ship, whether it's a refueling one or not, and before they deorbit it, and burn it up over the Pacific Ocean, they'll know they have X amount of fuel left in the system. They'll fire that for sometimes 10, 20 minutes. I mean, they'll burn out most of that fuel in that Progress ship to push the International Space Station forward, actually push it forward, and by gaining speed, they gain height, and they have to do this. They do that on a regular basis. Sometimes, they'll gain 8, 10, 12, 14 miles in altitude. Shuttle used to do it on a regular basis when it was in operation. Back to you. Missed your name, but this is Paul WS2N.
Okay, his name is Matt. Go ahead, Matt, and wait for the beeps.
Yeah, thanks. No, that was very interesting. I was just wondering because, I remember Skylab falling, and I'm wondering what the lifespan of the ISS is. And your name's Matt, KD2PPF, and I appreciate your answer for that.
As it is right now, I think the International Space Station requires or receives a boost about 2 or 3 times per year. Isn't that true, Paul? Over to you, WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, well, whenever the Progress They'll give it a boost. So, yes, it's about two or three times a year, as far as I know. They have other ways of actually making the spacecraft go, or the ISS go a little, let's call it slower. Let's say they need to slow it down a little bit, because they know that there might be, you know, an impact possibly coming up, you know, a month from now. And let's slow the orbit down. They'll actually turn the solar wings, you know, and start facing it in the direction of travel for a while. And then, you know, because the, you know, the air is rarefied. I mean, there are molecules up there. So there is some slight drag. And by doing that, it acts like a wing, or, you know, and it'll actually slow the ISS down. Conversely, too, if they turn everything angle, you know, angle the panels, you know, into the direction of travel, too, they can, you know, make sure that they won't slow down and avoid a possible collision with something that might be up there. That's another possibility we drop. Lifetime of this station, well, you know, first components were put up in 1999. You had the shuttle bring up, it brought up, they called it a Unity central module. Unity went up, and attached to it, it had two docking pieces, pressure mating adapter number one and pressure mating adapter number two, one on one side, one on the other. And one side was used to dock with the Zarya, the functioning cargo block. That Zarya was the first big launch by Russia. They launched on a proton rocket, and it docked with autonomously. It docked with the with our Unity vehicle. So that all happened in 1999, and then it was built out from there. At that time, they said the ISS is going to be good for 15 years. Let me drop it. That was the lifespan at the time. Since then, 2003 came along, and Columbia burnt up on reentry, and delays and problems. And next thing you know, you know, years later, and here we are, 2018, and it's planned on going right now until 2025. What happens after that will be up to Congress, whether or not they refund it. A lot of people would like to refund it to 2028, and naturally I agree with that. But it does cost you around $3 or $4 billion of NASA money to keep the ISS in operation every year. Back to you, Dick.
Make a guess for me, Paul, alongside of Matt's question. If for some reason we lost for a significant period of time the ability to do any boosting of the International Space Station, assume that by some magic we've got enough cargo, so that's not a problem. We're not running out of sustainable materials. But no boosting would take place. What's the real life of the International Space Station if it wasn't being boosted? And their own boosting capability, I have the impression, is kind of limited, and you don't want to do too much of that. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, how long would it stay in orbit without touching it? Wow. I'm sure they could get, you know, 3 years out of it. That would be my best guess. But I really don't know, Dick. Never thought about it. So many vehicles are going up there, pushing it along. They're going to know when they want to deorbit it. And when they do, I think they're going to take it apart, different modules, deorbit it, you know, a piece at a time. So, in fact, the Russians want to keep their modules. They want to separate it and create their own, you know, their own space station. So, I mean, you know, if that happens, 2025, NASA decommissions it. It would also, a lot of people, let me drop it, in Congress would like to
eventually make this a commercial operation. They've done some studies, and they're having a hard time trying to do the math and figure out what kind of money for the science that's going to be done up there commercially. Are you going to set up a manufacturing plant? Are you going to be able to, create $3 or $4 million, that's what I said before, it takes to keep the International Space Station afloat? Are you going to be able to have a productive company do that? I don't know. Back to you, Greg.
And I was called away for a second. You probably already answered this question from Matt, but maybe you have to repeat it for me. If all the boosting capability to keep the International Space Station at the correct altitude came from their own on-orbit capability, how long could they do that? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, I don't know. I do know they drop, I think it's roughly 10 miles every year. Something like that. So, and then it accelerates year after year. It's not the same. You start to get down. You get down to 150 mile range, and it's going to be over real soon. Maybe 6 months after that, I guess. So that's why I guess it's like 3 years. But I really don't know. Like I said before, I don't know. Back to you, sir.
But do they have any thrusting capability on board right now? That's question number one. And question number two. In the past, when they knew that there's going to be a while before something comes up like Progress to do some boosting, have they ever gone into a low cross-sectional mode? In other words, they arrange the solar panels in such a way so it gives minimum wind loading. So how much thrusting capability do they have, and have they ever intentionally stretched that by using low cross-section modes in the past? Over to you, Paul. K2RIW.
Yeah, well, they've turned the panels, forward because they don't want the expected drag to slow it down because they might be coming into contact with something flying up there. For that reason, I've heard that they've done that. You have the fuel in the Zvezda Russia module, which they could use to accelerate the space station. And I think to some degree, they've done that. They'll do that on a regular basis anyway. They want to make sure all those thrusters keep working. So, let's see. I'm trying to think if there's any other thing that you said that I'm trying to answer. Okay, was there another question there?
So when they use Zvezda, the Russian module, to do thrusting, they're using up that fuel, and I don't think that fuel is used for anything else other than thrusting. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, unless they want to reorient the station for some reason. Sometimes they do that. If you have like the Cygnus just went up, depending on the location of the attitude of the space station at the time, they might want to change it a little bit to have the docking point more at the zenith point. The docking point usually is usually the comes off the Harmony node or the Unity node, and they want that exactly pointing exactly in a certain direction. So they might use the thrusters to change the attitude of the space station temporarily until they dock it, and then it's all burnt and bulk it up, and then they'll move back again. But otherwise, it's just used for thruster purposes. Originally, the original ISS, you have all these sections, these truss pieces from in the front of the space station. Going out and holding all the solar panels and dropping. You have the main one that's attached to Destiny, and that's called the zero truss section. And then you go to to the starboard side. You'll have the number one truss section. Then you'll have the number three and the number four, five, and six. Going the other way, on the port side, you have the zero section in the middle on mounted on Destiny. And then you have number one, number three, number four, number five, number six. Notice I didn't say number two. You don't have a starboard two, and you don't have a starboard port. At one time, the original design, you were going to have that. There were going to be thrusters sitting, you know, attached to this thing with tanks and everything. That was the original design. That was all scrapped. Let me drop this. Because they knew they had enough. They had enough to get up and go with the Russian Zezla in the back to keep them going if they had to. So that was all scrapped, and that's why you have 11 sections. Truss sections, you know, go from one end to the other with all these big solar panels sticking on the ends of them, and you don't have 13 back either.
What's your guess as to the maximum amount of boosting that a Progress ship can give? I presume it's the extra fuel left over, because you do want to deorbit the Progress. And I'm not sure whether, I'm pretty sure Progress deorbits and burns up on the way down. We don't recover that one. But how much boosting can a Progress give you? Can it raise the altitude of the International Space Station 20 miles, so to speak, and you do that two or three times per year? WS2N, K2LAW.
Now, I seem to remember, I think it was 8 to 10 miles or something. The shuttle, I believe it was 14. No, I'll have to check. Depending on how much fuel is left, too. You know, they'll do like a 30-minute burn if they can to change the altitude of that space station. Whatever fuel they have on board. That's one of the reasons they like to have these, well, see, when the Progress goes up, or the Soyuz goes up. It originally used to take, you know, 3 days to you know, to dock at the space station. They've cut it down to six orbits. Let me drop it. They would also like to cut it down to 1.5 orbits. They've been unsuccessful with that. I mean, you know, the space station has to be right above Kazakhstan when they launch these things. Right above it at the air. You know, almost, you know, the inclination has to be exactly matched with that to do this. And then they can make it in 3.5 hours from launch to docking, which is great. It saves a lot of fuel. It leaves a lot of fuel extra for, you know, boosting the space station. It's one of the advantages of it. The disadvantage of it is if they miss their window, they have to wait quite a while to try it out again, and they usually scrap that plan, and they usually go with the 36-hour plan. Back to you, sir.
Now, I'm going to try to explain what I think you just said, and you've got to correct me on this one. When a object is in orbit, the plane of that orbit is essentially fixed with reference to inertial space. So the plane of that orbit, tilted at some number of degrees compared to the equator, the satellite keeps going around in that exact plane. The Earth is rotating underneath. Since each orbit is a roughly hour and a half, low Earth orbit, and Earth moves 15 degrees per hour, so hour and a half it moves, 22.5 degrees or something like that. So the satellite keeps coming over the same latitude on Earth once every hour and a half, but the Earth has turned 22.5 degrees. So in order for everything to come out just right, there's a very specific, you've got to choose the exact orbit and the right time of that orbit in order to do one of these precise launches. Is that roughly what's going on, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, you have to be, if you're off over, what is it, over 3 degrees, you're not going to make it. So you got to be within that. But to get this 3-hour time frame, you need to be right on the money. You know, you want to be, when you go around, you want to make sure that the space station's there and not, you know, half a degree off your port side. We actually did it back in the 1960s. We had the Agena rocket and the Gemini rocket. Remember the Gemini? Sent two people up at one time when they were practicing and learning how to rendezvous with things. The Agena rocket was the docking module that they were going to attach to. Well, Agena ran on batteries. It didn't have solar panels. It didn't have, nothing fancy to keep the electric supply going inside that spacecraft. So when Agena went up, right after that, an hour and a half later, the Gemini would take off and try to catch it. Of course, that was eventually successful. So, it's doable. And then the Russians have done it once. They got it down to 6 hours with the crew one time. Maybe twice. Maybe twice with the crew. And then they tried again with another Progress launch, and it was delayed. They didn't make it. So to do this on a regular basis, apparently it's not easy. Everything has to go just right, like you said. Back to the WS2M.
Yeah, when you and I are standing on the Earth, if we were near the equator, we're moving close to 1,000 miles an hour to the east because of Earth rotation. That motion of you standing on the ground before you launch is taking you out from under this beautiful orbit of the thing you want to match up with. The thing that's in orbit is in that plane that's fixed in space, and you're on the surface of the Earth before the launch, and you're moving 1,000 miles an hour away from that plane. So you launch early or you launch late, you're going to be in a nice orbit, but you're going to miss the space station, or you're going to... you got to make sure your orbits line up correctly. The timing of the orbits has got to be right. That window to do the right launch, that's a tough one. Okay, Paul, I think I'm going to go over to Roy now. Is that okay with you? AC2, WS2N, K2RIW.
Very good. And, anytime you want to do it this way, it's fine with me. You want to go back to the other system, that's okay, too. And remember, a couple of years from now, we got Dream Chaser going up there. So they've already got a contract with NASA, so that's not going to go away. That's the one that looks like a small space shuttle. And that's going to dock with the space station, come back and land. We'll have plenty of things to talk about. So plenty of nets to do this. So if you can think of any questions out there, you want to send them along, send them to Roy, his email. And... He'll follow the questions either to me or technical questions to Dick. Back to you, Dick. K2RIWWS1. Go ahead, Bruce.
Okay. This is AC2GS. Dick, are you sure you want me to go first? I thought LEGO had questions. And also, K2UPS added that the orbit of the ISS decays 3 kilometers per month, he says. It would take about a year and a half. Years to fall to Earth.
Wow, good information. And maybe, to be fair, we should alternate weeks. One week Roy goes first, one week Paul goes first. We'll consider that as a possibility. K2LEG, yes. That was Dennis. So maybe Dennis has a brief question. Let's go to Dennis. K2LEG, K2RIW. Go ahead, Dennis.
Good evening, K2RIW on the net, K2LEG. Just a comment first is I'm very impressed with this network. I've been listening for several months. I'm Cold Spring, New York, not Cold Spring Harbor. So I'm about 40 miles north. Anyway, my question is, I'm in a condominium and I'm stacking squalos. And I've got two up there, and it's way improvement over a single, and I'm going to put four up, but they're not going to be four stacked vertically. They're going to be side by side. Would I should I expect another 3 dB or thereabouts? And what would the pattern antenna band be like?